CliffCentral.com. All right, there's some Post Malone. It's called Circles, CliffCentral.com. New song that I was just introduced to. See, I do take suggestions from time to time. I'm not a complete ignoramus. I try very hard not to be. I'll tell you what, there's someone who is absolutely not an ignoramus, and he's going to be joining us in the Burning Platform next. He's Canthan Pillay. I'm going to find out what's going on in current affairs, all the big stories in the news. It's all brought to you by Nando's, who are the only people brave enough to actually bring you that kind of thing, right? So we can talk about the stories you care about this morning. And by the way, we'll be joined by two really interesting journalists. First of all, Khotatso Madisa, who is at the Sowetan, ex-deputy digital editor of the Sowetan, to discuss my money and Trollope's resignation. And Khotatso was actually at the DA press conference yesterday, so we'll talk to Khotatso. We'll speak to Julieta Talevi. Julieta is the money editor at the Financial Mail. We'll talk about the ESCOM implications in the economy and what it means for all of us. But first, Canthan, how are you?
A bit stunned into submission, because I was actually wrong. I said Mashaba would be gone in 3 weeks, and he was gone in 3 days.
Yeah, but your prediction was good.
Yeah, it was basically the essence of intuition is making an informed conclusion with incomplete information, which is pretty much what I did.
Huh. People are apparently writing to you and saying, what else can you tell us, O Nostradamus?
That the world's going to end in a few billion years?
All right, the Burning Platform is brought to you by Nando's. Let's get into some stories. While we're on the DA, we may as well spend a bit of time talking about them. Here is Musi Maimane resigning in a big conference yesterday that I suppose he thought people cared about. But here it is. I mean, let's for a moment pretend we do.
And in the end, we've come to the conclusion that despite my best efforts, perhaps the DA is not the best vehicle which is suited to take forward the vision of building one South Africa. And therefore, it is with great sadness that in order to continue this fight for the vision I strongly believe and the country I so dearly love, I will today step down as leader of the DA. I'll continue my role as parliamentary leader.
All right, blah, blah, blah. So what do we think?
Well, that was pretty much the outcome that everyone was expecting. But I think the fundamental question for me is that if this was a principal break from the Democratic Alliance, why simply step down as leader but not resign from the party altogether? So, that's kind of a way of just saying, well, yeah, but in the interim, I actually need to, have a paycheck. So let me just stick in parliament for
a while. All politicians in this country, certainly the ones that we know the names of, they need the money. They need the job.
Well, except for Mashaba and, his... he gave a very... But we can come back.
What do you think of his reasons? No, let's dwell on him for a little bit. You predicted that he would leave. It was much quicker than you thought it would be, but... He blamed Helen Ziller, and Helen Ziller had this to say yesterday.
I have always been friends with Herman Mashaba, and this morning we had a wonderful little chat on WhatsApp, and I'm not a vindictive person. I don't know why he's come up with these arguments suddenly. There must be something else that lies behind his resignation, and now he quickly uses this convenient card to give himself a justification. There's much more behind the scenes than meets the eye. So Herman Mashaba and I have always been friends, and we've had a very nice little engagement on WhatsApp today, so I feel good about that.
Show us the screenshots, Helen. Come on. What do we think?
I think that the screenshots would get hauled out at the point at which there's denial from the part of Mashaba, and there's unlikely to be that denial. Look, I think that people play these games behind the scenes.
So why do you think Mashaba, because that's really what started this domino collapse that's going on at the moment. Well, why do you think he resigned, and what do you believe the real reasons are for his resignation, and the overall health of the DA we can discuss after that?
Well, essentially, if you read through the DA report, which is the report that effectively said that the core leadership of the DA should be stepping down, that report points out, and this is something that we've actually discussed in this space before, that the relationship between the DA and the EFF in the city of Johannesburg, or, a marriage of convenience to allow Mashaba to gamble, had actually undermined the DA, because it meant that the DA was not able to deliver on its core promises, which is you know, good governance.
And they were compromising the whole time to keep the EFF on board. And we know that Herman has gone from hero to zero in terms of some people's approach to him.
Yeah, certainly, you know, I was.
You were very cross. Pumi brought it up the other day and said, please ask Canthan if he's still cross about the potholes or is there more?
I'm still cross about the potholes. Yeah, it's the potholes, it's the traffic lights and picking up trash, which has still not been done. And the interesting thing, though, in terms of Mashaba's speech, he made a big deal about having left Johannesburg in a significantly better place than it has been before. No, that's rubbish. Well, you know, essentially there was 4 billion rand in the bank account at the time at which Mashaba took over, and there's 4 billion rand sitting in the bank account right now.
So nothing's changed.
Well, actually, you know, if you inflation adjust, then... Yeah, well, I think what is true is that at some levels, there's been a lot of efficiencies that he's introduced in the sense that he's killed a lot of the contracts that used to be in place during the time with the previous ANC government. But at the same time, he's brought in his own contracts, which don't necessarily show any results yet. So the inner city development stuff, for example, there's 20 billion commitment towards that. And construction on those buildings was supposed to have started last month. I don't know to what extent that has actually happened.
Well, what about the overall health of the DA? Because these leaders, Ethel Trollope says he's too old, he's too white, he has the wrong hairstyle. Musi, we heard, was very emotional about his leaving, but it's something that this report that you're talking about recommended.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, it's usual, it is normal in politics in a functioning democracy for the leader of a party who has not performed in the elections to resign.
That's absolutely correct. Except if that was the rule, then the ANC would have lost its leadership in every single election that they've gone backwards for the past, ever since Thabo Mbeki was ousted, because he was the only person who actually built on the ANC support base.
Yeah, so he should have hung around then, according to that logic.
Exactly.
All right, well, let's go to Khotatso. Hi, Khotatso, nice to talk to you. How are you? Oh, Sia, I thought you said Khotatso was there. Why must you lie to me, Sia? Hurts so badly. It really does. I wanted to talk to Khotatso because at the DA's press conference yesterday, there was this funny lineup of people. So there was Helen, there was Musi, there was Ethel. There was someone else, I think one of their spokespeople. Hi, Khotatso, how are you?
Hi, Gareth, I'm good. How are you?
Good morning. Nice to talk to you. Khotatso Madisa is on via Skype with us this morning. What was going on in that room at the DA press conference yesterday? And tell us what everybody's facial expressions were when the cameras weren't on.
It was a marvel to watch. look, Gareth, when we arrived, we already knew that Musi Maimane was leaving the DA. Mm-hmm. I mean, when have you ever seen a DA leader addressing a DA press conference without DA colors being seen anywhere in the room? I mean, they covered the DA podium in black, in a black cloth. They removed all the DA logos that are in the room. It was really a dark day. And when they arrived, it was clear. So just before they came out, we got an indication that Ethel Trollope, who is the former mayor of the Nelson Mandela Bay and is the federal chairperson. Remember, there's two bodies in there. There's a federal position. There's a federal council chairperson, which is now held by Helen Zille. But there's also a federal chairperson, the position that was held by Ethel Trollope. Mm-hmm. So we got an indication that he told the federal executive in that meeting that, look, if my money is leaving, I'm also leaving. So just when they were about to come down, we got that indication, and indeed they arrived together. It was Musi, it was Ethel, and then Helen Zille, as well as Solima Ladzi, the spokesperson, whose face, I mean, it's not far, it wouldn't be far-fetched to say that he was emotional. Solima Ladzi, he was a marvel to watch. I don't know. It was a marvel to watch.
So, I mean, did Helen Ziller say anything? Because she was lurking in the background there in the visuals that I saw. Was she required to say anything? And how was the response in the room? I mean, mostly it was journalists, I'll assume, to Musi's statement when it all happened.
It was mostly journalists. Yeah, it was mostly journalists, local, international. And the Musi on Musi, I think it was almost expected. It was just an official announcement.
Right.
Remember, as journalists, we do have people who tell us things on the side, and we were getting updates throughout the day, since the morning, from the time they met until they came out at 5:30. So it was we knew it was. We just waiting for the official announcement from him. And on Helen Ziller, she came out and said, thank both of them, Athol and Musi. Athol has been with the DA, I believe, even when it was not the DA. I think at the time when it was called the Democratic Party, I believe. So he's been with the party ever since. So she thanked them and to Musi, and she said that politics is a tough game.
Mm.
I mean, that was a marvel to watch. And she also said that they're not sure what they're going to, who's going to have to take over from Musi. Mm-hmm. Because usually, if the DA leader leaves, steps down, the federal chair takes over. But now the federal chair has also resigned. So that leaves them in the lurch because they don't know who needs to take over now. So, yeah, it was that she did speak, but she sort of tried to, you know, play down what this means. I mean, a leader of the party has resigned.
Wow,
that's a big step. Mind you, this is the first black leader, someone who, when he was brought in, and mind you, he was brought in by the very same Helen Ziller who like, he was his protege. I mean, he was her protege. I mean, so now this person that you brought in has lost you votes. I mean, as the organizational review report says,
right?
The pro black. Pro-black, pro-poor stature that he wanted the party to take has lost them votes, mostly white votes to the Freedom Front Plus and the organizational.
I've got to climb in on that point. This particular narrative about a pro-black, pro-poor position that he wanted to take was actually not quite true. Mm-hmm. I think that actually when he ended up supporting positions such as affirmative action and black economic empowerment generally, which had been contrary to established DA policy, that was the point at which it was departure from what they used to do previously. But certainly the words pro-black, pro-poor were never something that I've actually heard Musi himself retaining. But essentially the reason why and it's also not true to say that he was the first black leader of the DA, because Joe Seremane was the chairperson of the DA, taking over from the time of Tony Leon. And Joe Seremane has an impeccable political pedigree. He was PAC prisoner on Robben Island, and so I think right now a lot of the media narrative that we are seeing around what's happening in the DA is based on buying into an EFF line, essentially, about pro-black and pro-poor, and saying that the DA is against it, and trying to spin this.
Can I jump in? Mm-hmm. Let me jump in there. So what Musi wanted to do with the DA was to make the DA a party that can essentially remove the ANC from power. So he came with a narrative that says one South Africa for all. And he admits yesterday that before he came in, the DA was seen as a party for white people. And white people are the minority in South Africa. So in order for the DA to be able to unseat the ANC, they would have to also be a party that can, that black people can see as a home. These are his words. He says, no, it's a fact.
Except that's not quite true. And if we go back to and look at the DA review report, and let me quote very specifically. It says, in the wake of the 2016 local government elections, and remember that the DA actually built on its base significantly in the 2016 local government elections. They set themselves four objectives for 2019. First one was national growth. Mm-hmm. He didn't do that. They went backwards. Bringing the ANC under 50% in Gauteng, he didn't do that. Bringing the ANC under 50% in the Northern Cape, he didn't do that. And item four was retaining a majority in the Western Cape. And in fact, he only achieved one of those objectives. And nowhere in that is the question of any particular political narrative. So essentially, if the guy was the CEO of a corporation and was given these clear targets, and he failed to deliver on those targets, then the corporation would essentially oust him on that basis. So I think that the narrative right now that I was trying to do the best in terms of being inclusive, et cetera, just is a smokescreen around the fact that he failed to deliver on the fundamental objectives. What do you think?
Look, he did fail. He did fail. He did not get the DA where the DA wanted to go. Mm-hmm. And these are the objectives that he also said. That's a fact. He failed, and he admittedly failed, and he does say that one thing that he said there was that at the end of the day, the DA has always been but a vehicle to pursue and further the vision, his vision of One South Africa for All, and I am still wholeheartedly committed to this vision. So obviously, he's saying that the vision that he had, he could not pursue. He failed. He did fail. So he's saying that I failed in this vision that I wanted for the DA, and I've now realized that the DA is not the vehicle that I want that can see this vision through. So that's admission of failure, definitely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning, Khotatso. It's good to check in with you. And thanks for taking care of the press conference for us, giving us some insight into what happened there behind the scenes. But you see, there are these narratives that go around. And I'm starting to get very suspicious of anyone who even uses the term narrative, because it appears to me that this is a tool for manipulating ideas that aren't necessarily backed up by any facts. We are led to believe that there are two camps within the DA, and that may or may not be true. But a lot of this stuff is quite spurious, and it's reported through these very cloudy, hazy sources. You know, it's like the ANC's NEC. We never really know what goes on. I think that people are just losing faith in politics generally.
Yes, but Julius Malema always knows what goes on in the ANC.
Yeah, well, this is what he says, and no one ever contradicts him, so we have to believe him.
Good point.
Right?
Absolutely. But if we can just go back to this DA report, for a second, and I do want to, just go to the question of key findings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the key findings were the overwhelming view of those who made submissions was that the party leader, while immensely talented, committed to the cause, hardworking and wildly liked, can be indecisive, inconsistent and conflict averse. Hmm. And this has led to a lack of clarity around the party's vision and direction, confusion about the party's position on key issues, erosion of the party's unity of purpose,
yep,
deep divisions within the national caucus, and a breakdown of trust between the leader and some of the party structures. I mean, this is...
those are good enough reasons for someone to have to resign.
Yeah, absolutely. And
you don't need to look for a conspiracy theory.
And so when it came to recommendations, you know, the first recommendation says those ultimately responsible for the leadership and management of the party, the leader, the chairperson of Federal Council, and chief executive, step down and make way for new leadership.
Except that we've got old leadership coming back in.
Yes.
So that's not exactly ideal either. But who are the people who hold the future of the DA in their hands here? And does anyone actually care enough? This is my problem. It's like I didn't watch this thing yesterday. I saw like a clip of it this morning. And I failed to be moved. Like, I'm really sorry. I know this is the biggest opposition party. But it's almost as if, and I am more cynical than I've ever been, but it's almost as if you know, it's a ho-hum, so what situation. For most people in this country, I don't think it affects them.
No, I don't think so, except for people in the Western Cape, of course, who, you know, are terrified at the idea of a return of Marius Fransman to power in that in that province.
Oh, that's rightly.
Yeah.
That's a reason to be afraid.
But again, I keep going back to stuff that we've beaten on about, that if you work on the assumption that the DA had continued to grow at the same trajectory that they had at the time that Helen handed over to Musi, it would still have taken them to around about 2040, 2050 before they attained a majority, assuming that they had that steady incremental growth of about 8% in their base every single year. So it was never going to be a question of attaining Musi's vision of being the party that was going to be governing.
Yeah. All right. I think we've got to leave that alone. I do think that there probably are more points of view that will be aired in the future about this, but I think that the DA is, like all the parties at the moment, in crisis. I mean, I mentioned to Sia this morning, and I think it's true for the ANC, it's true for the EFF, it's certainly true for the DA now. They're all in a little bit of free fall, and they're looking to be relevant, where, you know, it's not an election year anymore. There's no reason for them to be... And listen to how dead quiet everybody's being in the ANC at the moment. The silence is absolutely deafening at the moment.
Yeah, you notice that as well, huh?
Right?
Uh-huh.
Just no one says a thing anymore in the ANC right now. And I wondered why you suppose that might be happening.
I suspect that right now everyone's actually keeping their powder dry. Hmm. You know, certainly those factions within the ANC are still very much there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that they're also aware that at this time, it's not the time to actually be throwing stones. Because, you know, we do have Moody's coming up. We have the medium-term expenditure framework speech that needs to be coming up as well. And, you know, is this the time that they necessarily want to be collapsing the economy? No. You know, they'll probably wait for Moody's to actually, you know, hold the line for a while. And I suspect that in the new year, we'll see them going back to the usual stuff. But the more interesting thing for me is let's look at what happens in the city of Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
Because we now have a scenario where Mashaba is out. And if you look in terms of who has the capacity to form governments in Johannesburg, ANC is still the biggest party in Johannesburg, and they're holding talks with the IFP. IFP holds 5 seats. And in order to form a government, they need to get 136 seats.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's 51% of the votes
right.
in the city of Johannesburg. So assuming they get all of the IFP on board, and assuming they get the other rats and mice parties, with the exception of the Freedom Front Plus and COPE, they will have 134 seats.
So it's enough?
No, it isn't.
Not enough.
It's not enough, yes. So
what happens then to the city of Joburg? Do we just carry on into free fall?
Yeah, well, that is essentially the scenario that we've got right now. And so effectively, the EFF is massive in the city of Joburg. They hold 30 seats.
Yeah.
So if the EFF gets together with the ANC can form a government. If the EFF gets together with the DA can form a government. But without the EFF support, neither the ANC nor the DA can form a government.
Huh.
So the question really becomes, what should be the solution for the city of Johannesburg? And I really think that it needs to be an ANC and DA coalition.
Would that be possible?
Look, I think that it needs to be the test of real politics in the city. I was pointing out to people this week that if you take the city of Johannesburg, you take its GDP, which is $76 billion, the GDP of the city of Johannesburg. So if city of Johannesburg was a country, it would be the ninth biggest economy in Africa.
Hmm.
Okay, it would displace Ghana, which is currently sitting at number 9.
Right.
Yes, and you know, then push Ghana out to the top 10, and then I think push the DRC into number 11. So this is huge. City of Johannesburg's economy if you take our SADC partners, if all of our immediate neighbors, you take Botswana, you take Namibia, you take Eswatini, take Lesotho, take Mozambique, and you take Zimbabwe, combine all of their economies together, and the city of Johannesburg is a bigger economy than all of those countries.
That's phenomenal.
Put together.
Phenomenal. Yeah. What is the proportion of the GDP of the country that Johannesburg is responsible for, of South Africa?
It is something like about 11%, I think. Yeah, okay. It's huge.
It's phenomenal.
Yes, and of course, Johannesburg's economy, you know, even though the rest of the country has been in free fall, Johannesburg has continued to post economic growth because, the three centers, Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban, have posted positive economic growth even during these tough times. It's the rest of the country that's been in negative territory and has pulled it backwards. Huh. So you can't afford to have the city of Johannesburg in free fall. Yeah. And I'm saying you need an ANC-DA coalition because the EFF is the biggest threat to the running of the city of Joburg. It's doing everything that is contrary to what a vibrant capitalist economy needs in order to be able to develop. So you have a scenario where you put in place an ANC mayor and put in place a DA financial controller and let all of the decisions then get argued out in the city council. And perhaps we'll then actually go back to having a functional city.
And maybe it'll prove that the DA and ANC can work together in other places.
Well, they're going to have to at some point.
Yeah.
Because it's either that or they continue to have the situation where they're effectively handing control to the EFF. And I don't think either of them want that.
No. And of course, ideologically, that stops them dead in their tracks from achieving anything.
Yeah.
All right. Well, here's just one last thing that people are asking, and maybe you can help us with this, Canton. A big chunk of the DA report is from the Institute of Race Relations, which Zilla is a member of. Clearly, that report is not independent and objective. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't know how they draw that conclusion. I mean, which part of it is from the IRR?
Well, I don't know. This is a rumor that's been going around for a long time. In fact,
yes,
Phumzile Van Damme was saying that the IRR is secretly a shadow institution that controls the DA.
Yeah, and look, and again, we've discussed that on this particular show as well. The IRR's job, even during the time of the
think tank, right?
It was a think tank, and the role of a think tank is to influence policy in particular directions. Mm-hmm. And does the IRR have a vested interest right now in terms of steering all political parties around the path of its particular objectives? I think the answer to that is yes.
Yeah.
Does that mean that it exerts influence? Yeah, sure it does. But, you know, to say that they actually authored the report, I think that's actually taking it to extremes because I certainly don't think that Tony Leon, for example, is a pawn of the IRR.
Well, you know, the people love a conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And in the absence of any theory at all, the conspiracy theory is always preferred.
Yes, but I've no doubt that there are people who look effectively. If you look in terms of the African National Congress, mm-hmm. their think tank is the Communist Party.
Right. Well, that's true, and nobody's complaining about that. Although we probably should. All right. Some other things that are worth getting into. I know that this horrible demon keeps raising its ugly head every week, and most people are sick of hearing about it. But Eskom is back in the news after rolling blackouts again. What we call load shedding in South Africa. And clearly there is still no solution to the impasse, although Cyril assures us that he's busy at work trying to fix Eskom.
Well, I think one of the things that we can actually say hallelujah to is the fact that when the latest bailout bill was passed, it had all of these restrictions that were put in place by Treasury in terms of how money gets spent, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing because it's not a blank check. It's actually saying that firstly, you can't take this money and use it to pay salaries and bonuses. You're actually using it to write off
debt.
Well, to pay back debt. And we're actually expecting that we get regular reports from you that are showing how the money is flowing every step of the way. So if it's coming down to, you know, it's like you have a troublesome employee in the workplace and you essentially need to micromanage them to ensure that you are keeping within the letter of the labor laws in order to be able to fire them. And so if you're drawing a correlation between Eskom being a troublesome employee and Tito Mboweni being the CEO, this is in essence what's happening.
But Canton, We also have seen why the rolling blackouts and 6 billion rands worth of diesel had to be burnt last week.
Well, it was 6 billion since the beginning of the year, not
since
last
the
week.
Beginning of the year then.
Yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, this is a question of maintenance and upkeep.
Yes.
It's a mechanical and management failure that has resulted in these last bouts of blackouts.
Well, essentially, it was during the Zuma era, money that was meant to be diverted to maintenance and management of these systems was actually diverted into the pockets of other players.
Yeah. I do want to get on at this point, because I think she might be able to help us figure a lot of this out. Julieta Talevi, who's on the line from, she's the money editor of the Financial Mail, to talk about some of the financial implications of Eskom's current state. And she's on Skype to join us this morning. Julieta, how are you? Julieta? Oi, again. Sia, you promised me things and then, you know.
I think Sia is
he's
still
full of lies this
he's,
morning.
He's still in a Washington state of
I'm
mind.
I'm gonna start calling him Crooked Sia. Is she there? Still not. Okay. You know, Sia, next time don't promise me anything. Just we are gonna talk to her in a second. But apparently for the financial year from until March 2019, we've got the 6 billion rand worth of diesel that's been burnt, as they've been struggling with load shedding. Eskom says there's a low probability of load shedding for the rest of the week as the broken Medupi coal conveyor belt and faulty power units return to service. Eskom warned the power supply is vulnerable, that any shocks could result in more outages. All of this is very reassuring, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the discussion around the broken conveyor belt is I don't want to... You know, I'm going to get accused of dropping F-bombs just for the sake of dropping F-bombs. But again, you know, once again, this was a clusterfuck of note.
Mm.
And I think those of us who track, you know, knowledgeable people on social media. So Chris Yelland is one of those that, that I actually rate quite highly. And and he actually unpacked the stuff that went down in terms of what went toes up at Medupi. And I'll just read an extract from it. He said, for some time, the stackers that load coal from Exxaro's Grootgeluk, you know, inappropriately named mine, of course, Grootgeluk mine, onto the stockpiles at the Medupi coal stockyard, and the reclaimers that take coal from the stockpiles to feed coal have not been working. So to get coal to the boilers, the coal stockyard was bypassed. And the single main coal conveyor feed from Grootgeluk was feeding the power station directly without any redundancy in the system. So effectively, Medupi was running with minimal coal stock at its disposal. Thus, when the single main conveyor feed from Grootgeluk mine failed on the Eskom side with a broken shaft, Medupi was left with no coal feeding its boilers other than about one or two ships worth of coal in its bunkers. So...
It's like the most incompetent people in the world have been asked to handle something this important.
Exactly. So you know, the problem was that you know, you've kind of got, you know, spit and chewing gum that's holding the entire thing together.
It's like those people who have like a wire steering wheel in their car because the actual steering wheel is broken. All right, we've got Julieta on the line. Hi, Julieta, how are you?
How's it going? Very well, thanks. And you?
Good. Nice.
I'm laughing.
Nice to talk to you. Are you laughing?
At the description of Eskom.
Well, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what Eskom is currently doing to us from a debt point of view, and how the effects of that in the broader economy are being felt. But of course, this is something that's not going to go away anytime soon. Canton's already hinted at the fact that Treasury have placed restrictions on how this bailout money is going to be spent. But how do you see all of this on the macroeconomic scale?
Well, on the macroeconomic scale, it's a total disaster for South Africa, because as Canton, he used the cluster, the cluster F word, you know, you've got Eskom debt of 451 billion rand, which is extraordinary, and it's backed by government guarantees. Now, Eskom can't trade its way out of the situation, so it is wholly reliant on government to prop it up. Now if any of those guarantees get called, and if, you know, if anyone says, look, I'm not prepared to keep on funding Eskom anymore, you will spark a sort of chain reaction of other banks or lenders calling in their guarantees, in which case, you know, you might have to have the government kind of step in one fell swoop to support the utility. So that is, its stretched balance sheet, Eskom's stretched balance sheet, has become South Africa's massive financial headache. And the problem is that we are a borrowing nation. So we pay interest on our debt. And the Eskom, the overruns at Medupi and Kosile, the cost of this, the 451 billion rand that sits on Eskom's balance sheet, now has to be funded by the state. So that's money that should have been used for other areas of the South African economy, for social services, for police, for teachers, for road building, for dam construction. But no, it's actually just going to service Eskom's debt. It's not even going to service new builds. It's simply the interest on the debt that Eskom has racked up in an extraordinarily fast way.
So what's the way out? According to you, if you were suddenly in charge of all of this mess and I asked you to solve the problem, based on the people you speak to in your position, I mean, you don't mess around. You talk to some high flyers and some important business executives and some CEOs. You're the money editor at the Financial Mail. I don't expect you to solve all our problems, but if this did land on your lap, how would you... Yeah, go on. Solve all our problems.
Okay, all right. There's, I think, a few things that you have to do. I think, and this is having spoken to someone who's very smart, who was, I think, quite keen to get involved in the leadership at Eskom, is that you actually sell your electricity forward. So you know what. So this is one option. You know what Eskom produces electricity. Mm-hmm. If you had to, I suppose, do a deal with the utility, it's like when a gold company hedges its gold production, so it sells it forward. So it says, I will sell a certain amount of my gold to you at a set price in order for kind of money coming in to reflect that. So it kind of provides you with immediate cash boost. So that's one option, okay? I think the other is that you have to grasp the nettle and cut the staff complement at Eskom. You've got to make this an efficient company, and this is anything but efficient. I mean, you know, you guys know the stats. I think there's 16,000 more people than the World Bank feels Eskom deserve to have working for it, or to have working for it. You've got 40,000 people now, whereas a decade ago, you had about 30,000 people, and Eskom is producing less electricity. So your productivity rates have plummeted, and then you continue to, give above inflation salary increases, like the 7% increase that was awarded earlier this year, which I think probably broke the camel's back for Phakamani Khadebe, who, as we know, resigned. So, you know, that's one thing. You've got to play hardball with the staff and the unions, and then I think, look, that's not necessary. So okay, that's going to help your. You know, you have to do some cost cutting. This is what, I mean, you were talking about. If you run Eskom as you would run a well-run company, if at some point there's a cost crunch, generally staff will have to be let go. Okay, yeah. So you know, this is what would happen in a normal company. And the other thing is that you've got to, the shareholder government has got to respect the arm's length relationship that should exist between Eskom and itself. And it is endlessly tinkering in the board, in the executive. I mean, you saw that with the press conferences that were held with Jabu Mabuza and Phakamani Khadebe and Pravin Gordhan. Gordhan, you know, doing the talking. It's your executive who should be doing the talking and making decisions.
But you see, when government's called on to bail them out the whole time, you do sort of have a crisis of conscience in terms of who's actually in charge. And I can't help it that while you're talking, and I feel for you because I've dropped this potato right on your lap, but the fact is that there are no easy solutions to this Eskom crisis. And
No.
Canton's looking at me now, and he's frowning.
Now there's easy solutions to the Eskom crisis. And I said this a couple of months ago. I said, look, the basic issue that we've got with Eskom is that they are selling a product at a loss. So in other words, it costs them more to produce every megawatt of electricity than the money that they charge for it. Mm-hmm. And so they're never going to be able to ever turn this thing around, because when they say that we want to actually push up the price of electricity to a point where it is actually profitable for us, NERSA turns around and says, no, actually, you're not allowed to do that. You have to keep selling electricity at a loss. So as long as you've got this regulatory framework that is holding back your ability to charge whatever you want for the electricity, we're never going to claw our way out of it. And it creates an artificial market, because it then means that people would not be able to do things like putting in their own generators in order to run their business, because it would be more cost effective to do so. So this regulatory framework is something that holds us back. But the more fundamental issue for me is that you're never going to recover the money that you spent on Medupi. You're never going to recover the money that you spent on Kusile. So, and this is where I made out the case that you take all of Eskom's debt and you effectively write it off. You take that into the fiscus. Because right now, as citizens, we're paying for it anyway. But what that does is it resets Eskom's balance sheet so that the money is no longer being diverted to paying interest. And then you can start managing Eskom as a proper business from scratch. Yeah, so that's my quick solution.
Look, I mean, you know, assume Eskom's debt entirely. In other words, I mean, which you've basically done anyway, giving the government guarantees and the endless bailout.
Yeah.
You know, so, I don't actually know why they don't do that. I think, you know, they seem to be stuck in quite a lot of paralysis.
Well, it's also because the ANC
government level, other than
I don't think the ANC understand.
Desk, you know?
Yeah, Tito Mboweni's trying, and then when he does, he has to apologize and tell the ANC that he's sorry for having a good idea that actually makes sense and is reasonable and is based on supply and demand economics. But it seems to me that the ANC in general does not understand economics. And there are very few people in the ANC who do. So this may be the nexus of our problem.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think there's a significant chunk of people. Mm-hmm. Julieta, I mean, I don't know how you rate Tito, but I certainly think that, you know, he understands economics. You know, he's Goldman Sachs trained and ran the Reserve Bank reasonably well during his tenure out there. But it's exactly the point that the people who ultimately have to sign off on those decisions have their own vested interest to cater to. So even though you have policy people, and I think there are some smart people in the Treasury who put forth ideas that make a lot of sense.
Yeah, but I mean, Kenton, the thing is, there are lots of smart people in the Treasury, and Tito, as you say, he knows economics backwards. But the Treasury is kind of it's like the administrative arm of government. It doesn't set the policy. The policy is set by the Department of Public Enterprises or the Department of Public Works the NEC, and then it flows down into the different departments. Treasury is kind of, they're the bag man, they carry it out. You know, so they're not, obviously they can have inputs into how they think money should be spent, but they're kind of takers, if you like,
They're almost like the only adult in a child-run school.
Yeah, that's pretty much a good way to look at it.
That's the way I see it. All right, Julieta, I'm not going to plague you with any more complex questions about Eskom, because I do think that it is it's all of our responsibility to sort this out, or else we're going to have a complete failure of the economy. But I do thank you for your insights.
Yeah, look, I'm sure I'm not. Yeah, it's a pleasure. I'm not sure if I was very helpful, though.
No, you were. You were.
Maybe I think I might sort of shout less on Twitter in order to not get called by Cliff Central.
we like having you on, so thank you very much.
Okay, pleasure.
Right. Thank you very much. There's Julieta. She's with the Financial Mail. Canton, can I talk about two other things? Because we don't want to get caught and mired in Eskom for too long, do we? Here's something that someone online just put out, and I thought it was an interesting interview. A guy called Douglas Murray, who says, people used to admire people for heroism. Now we admire them for their suffering. Take a listen to this and then give us your thoughts afterwards. And if you have an idea on this, then you might want to message us to 0797482090. And the reason I play it is because this is going on in America, it's going on in South Africa, it's going on in politics all over the world. And it seems to me some kind of shift that this guy's picked up on. Take a listen.
There's an odd thing in our time where people seek the virtue points by suffering. It's a very strange thing in our society. People used to admire people for heroism, and now they admire them for suffering. Mm. So that the more you can claim to have suffered, the more admiration you'll get, and the more you'll be allowed to do. Mm. It's a very strange inversion, this, and there's all sorts of reasons for it. But it means that in the social media wars and in the political wars, there's this fascinating thing where people now boast about the offense they get. They boast about the online abuse. You know, we see it every day. I get so much abuse. So? I mean, first of all, it doesn't mean you're right. That's a very important thing to bear in mind. Just because you've got a lot of people being really rude about you does not mean you're right. Doesn't mean they're right either. But so there's this strange auditioning for respect by being the most insulted person in the village.
I mean, that's interesting, right? That comes from a podcast I listened to not so long ago. What do you think of it? Because it is something we're seeing increasingly in people people like the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes. We saw it in the Phumzile Van Dammes here in South Africa. We've seen it in Julius. We've seen it in a lot of places.
I think people make the mistake of assuming that the dominant narrative on social media actually reflects real life.
It does not.
And, you know, again, it's a point that we keep banging on around here. And yes, you know, social media, just simply because of the fact that you can have an amplification of particular viewpoints, doesn't mean that actually translates to reality on the ground.
Speaking of reality, did you hear about what happened with Hillary? Also going on a podcast, this is where all the breaking news happens now on podcasts, where she claimed that two people on the left with her, one of them in the Democratic Party with her, Tulsi Gabbard, is a Russian asset. Two people are Russian assets, according to her. Donald Trump's a Russian asset. It seems Russia control everything in America, according to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, so and the interesting thing about Tulsi Gabbard is that, you know, if I look in terms of the entire lineup of U.S. presidential candidates, Tulsi Gabbard is the only person there that I think actually is worth anything in that entire lot. You know, fairly remarkable.
She's a serving major in the reserve force, but she has actually been a soldier when she was deployed.
Yeah, real combat on the ground.
Right.
You know, certainly one cannot accuse her of being a softie at that level. And the fact that she pushes an agenda that says the U.S. needs to get out of these wars in strange places. Look, let's just use an example right now about how narrative actually completely undermines the reality of stuff. You have the situation right now where the Kurds, and again, you know, let's recognize that the reason why the Kurds are in the duang that they are, it goes back to the First World War with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, where right. You actually had nation states that were carved out for almost every group.
Just like in South Africa, in Africa, where after the First World War, the imperial colonial powers had to dispose of these countries, which then asked for their independence and freedom. And they were really cut up in a quite bizarre way. Sometimes it had nothing to do with ethnic lines, some countries incorporated three or four tribes.
In terms of Africa, you'll see that a lot of the borders that are drawn up are basically straight lines, which ends up being quite disastrous. So if you look in terms of the southeastern part of the DRC and adjoining Uganda and Rwanda, essentially you have a Hutu nation that has a footprint across those three countries, but they were carved up into three separate countries instead of being demarcated into a single territory. So the Kurds became a victim of that process. And the Kurds have actually been fighting for an independent state. And effectively, what should have happened is at the end of the First World War, the Kurds should have had a chunk of Turkey, they should have had a chunk of Syria, and a chunk of Iraq. And that would have effectively given them their nation state, and everything would have been fine.
Well, it sounds tired and old, but it is the truth that the largest ethnic minority in the world without a homeland is the Kurdish people.
Absolutely right. But the question is now, is Syria, is Turkey, and is Iraq? Or is Iraq going to give up any of their individual pieces of territory? The answer is no, because, you know, hardly anyone gives up territory. So the Kurds have been fighting a bloody war against
First Saddam.
Well, all of these various places. But but the fact is, the only reason why the Kurds continue to be funded is because whenever someone wants to create a bulwark against one of the other powers, they end up getting funded. So the Americans funded the Kurds against against Saddam. And now you have a scenario where the Turks are very concerned about the idea that the Kurds could continue to have incursions upon their territory. So at the point at which the U.S. announces that it is withdrawing from Syria, and understand that none of these guys have the right to be in Syria, because the U.N. has not passed any resolution that gives anyone the right to be at war in Syria. So the U.S. has no right to have any troops out there. The Kurds have no right to have troops out there. The only people who have any right to be there actually happen to be the Russians, because they are there by the recognized Kurdish, Syrian government. And even then, their role tends to be...
So when people are, say they're upset, as many people in the Republican Party are with Donald Trump at the moment over his supposed abandonment of the Kurds, you're saying... Actually, he's probably within his rights to do this, and it's maybe a good thing for the United States. This is an argument we don't hear very much.
Well, it's absolutely a good thing for the United States, because Donald Trump's point from the get-go is that, look, the U.S. has been funding all of these wars all over the world and has never gotten any payback for it.
Which brings us back to Tulsi Gabbard, who was called the Russian asset by
Hillary.
Who's
effectively been saying the same thing. But
and,
what
and
that
she
means,
says we shouldn't be involved in warmongering. She called Hillary the queen of warmongering.
Which is, and she's absolutely correct, because if you look in terms of the fiasco that Libya today is, you can lay that entirely on the doorstep of Hillary Clinton. So, look, Trump has pulled out troops from Syria, but the troops that they had on the ground there were always a small force. He's announced that he's deployed troops into Saudi Arabia. Do you know how many troops he's deployed? 200.
Is that all?
Yeah, that's all.
Now that sounds reasonable.
Yeah, and they're there. So it's an entirely symbolic thing to say that he's deploying troops. The troops that he's pulled out from Syria, he's actually putting into Iraq. And again, that's a good thing to be doing, because Iraq is really the place where ISIS is most likely to resurge, if it does. Syria has never been a threat. You know, does Assad actually end up committing what a lot of us would consider to be genocide against his own people?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Of course.
Yes, but is he a threat to the surrounding countries? No. And, you know, my view on nearly all of these Arab states is that they're fundamentally undemocratic, they're fundamentally misogynistic, they're fundamentally homophobic. Just close off their borders.
And let them sort themselves out.
Sort themselves out.
This is what Trump's saying.
Yeah, and when they become civilized, we'll let them rejoin the rest of the world. And what's wrong with that logic? Everyone's saying we've betrayed the Kurds. Well, what are you suggesting, that the U.S. actually continue to fund an insurgency that's never going to give them a guarantee of territory? If you really want to be doing something about this, you need to be calling Syria and Iraq and Turkey to the table and saying, guys,
give up some land,
create an enclave, and then, you know, we can then protect you by ensuring that the Kurds actually play by international law. Now the Kurds can do pretty much what they want to.
And they are doing what they
want
to, which no one likes to take any recognizance of either. All right, so there's a lot of messiness going on there. Boris is also having his own degree of messiness in the UK at the moment with regard to Brexit postponement. We thought it was definitely going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. What's going to happen? Nothing.
The interesting thing about Boris, okay, is that... Think about this. He says that, okay, this is the deal and we need to push it through. But in fact, by the idiots in his parliament refusing to push that deal through, it means that Boris is going to get what he actually wants.
Which is a no-deal
Brexit. Which is a no-deal Brexit. And Boris is very firmly on track for a no-deal Brexit.
So why is he putting up this charade that he has a deal that he'd prefer?
Well, it's not that it's a charade. It's because in terms of the discussion that he hammered out with the EU... Is it a significantly better deal than the one that was hammered out by Theresa May? Absolutely.
Hmm.
Because it does...
So he's proven that he certainly outmaneuvered her, and that he'd got a better deal than she could
and,
have.
And also, you know, the
but
EU...
But that ultimately it's going to go to a no-deal Brexit.
Well, it's going to go to a no-deal Brexit, not because of the fact that it needs to go to a no-deal Brexit.
But because Parliament won't cooperate.
Because Parliament won't cooperate. And because he's, you know, effectively you've got a speaker.
So who is it in Parliament? Is it some of his own party that are making this difficult for him? Is it just Jeremy Corbyn and Labour?
Well, fundamentally, it's the Speaker of Parliament, who is going to be resigning, but ultimately gets to call the shots in terms of what gets put to the vote and when it gets put to the vote.
John Bercow.
Yes. And, there's a bit of a poison dwarf that we've got there, because he effectively ended up derailing the entire process.
What's in it for him? I mean, why would he do this?
Well, the same thing that's in it for Theresa May. They never wanted to be leaving the EU in the first place.
Okay. And he's become some kind of a proxy for those people who are Remainers.
And they're doing their damnedest to undermine a democratic vote.
All right. So, I mean, it's never a dull day on the Burning Platform. If you want to know any more about any of this, then we may have time for it again tomorrow. I mean, next week. But you can always email us. And Canton's a very busy man, but we try to include any suggestions that you have in the Burning Platform. And if you do for next week, then send us an email, gareth@cliffcentral.com. I'll pass it on to Canton and we can discuss some of the stuff that you want to put on the agenda for next week's Burning Platform. Canton, thank you very much.
An absolute pleasure as always. And see ya. I'm glad you're still in a Washington state of mind. And we need to see the pictures.
Yeah, Sia had a wild time in Washington. Didn't you, Sia?
Well. Oh, yeah. I have a whole gallery I'll Dropbox you now. I'll airdrop that to you.
All right, very nice. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow at 6 o'clock, bright and early. Have an excellent day and be good. Blah, 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 blah. CliffCentral.com.